everyone. Guess what? James Gunn wanted to start a relationship advice podcast.
That's true. That is true.
That is unbelievable.
I can't believe
Chris didn't tell me this.
Jenny Mallon Biggs and I were going to start a... It was relationship advice, but just basic psychological advice. Because my whole life, I wanted to be Dr. Drew. And I told Dr. Drew this every time I was on Loveline, that that's what I wanted my job to be. And we were going to do this advice show. And we had a deal to do it with this podcasting company. And then I got Guardians of the Galaxy, and I didn't have time, and I had to back out of it. And I was very bummed out about it because we were working hard on doing it.
Do you feel like,
because
like me, I love to dispense advice. Mm-hmm. I hate to take it, and I'm not great at taking my own advice at all. Are you similar to that, or are you pretty good about being, I don't know, you're a very disciplined person.
I'm very disciplined, yeah. But there are times when I know that my life goes in and out of being more disciplined about, you know, what I would think of as a spiritual aspect of my life and less disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
So I go in and out of, you know, I'm always working hard. That's pretty consistent. And then all of a sudden I start getting a little more, less comfortable in life. And I start to concentrate on those things that would make me feel happier, which are really simple things. And once I start doing that in a more disciplined manner, then I start being a lot happier.
And you don't have to get specific, but does work interfere with your personal? I mean, because in our industry, it tidal waves your personal relationships.
This job in particular is very hard on my personal life because I really have, a movie comes out like Guardians, and then I start working on Guardians 2, which is, you know, I start working on the day the first movie came out. I started writing that script. I started, you know, writing aspects of the script even long before that. But I started actually writing the script the day the first movie came out. And then that part's sort of a normal job, you know, writing. And then as time goes on, I start to go into pre-production and then post-production. And then I'm gone from everyone's life for a long time.
Yeah.
Because directing really takes almost all of your time.
And so anybody who's made it through to this point in your life has to have a very, very good, at least because I feel the same way. I mean, it's different for me because I'm not, whatever, it's a little different. But everyone in my life who's made it through to this point has to understand they have to be okay with me not getting back to them for a couple months. And
that's,
I feel
right,
very selfish. And sometimes they're just like, well, why can't you just even shoot me a text? And it's like, because I want to be able to commit more fully than just an emoji.
Yeah.
I want to be able to talk to you and catch up and whatever. And anyway, but yeah, I'm sure.
It's exactly the same. I think that I have friends that have to understand that I become a ghost for a few months, you know, or almost a year. I mean, I'll be here in Atlanta shooting Guardians 2 for 10 months. I'll be here. And pre-production, it's a little bit less rigorous, but now that we're shooting, it's really all of my time.
It's really hard when I get like those, are you mad at me texts? Did I do something wrong? Yeah. That's really tough. That's a tough one for me. I feel instantly a little peeved.
Yeah. I think it's hardest on relationships and, you know, almost every girlfriend I've ever had, I've broken up with at the start of a movie or halfway through a movie because of that very thing.
And my dad, I want to ask you about something else that's related to this, but my dad, on a side note, my dad and I are really close. My parents and I are really close, but he does this really annoying version of that because we talk all the time. He calls me at least once a day. I don't talk to him every day, but he calls me at least once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't talk to him, like by day three, he'll start sending me texts because he knows how to text now. I'm worried about you. Is everything okay?
Mm.
Which is like the version of, are you mad at me? Which is the version of like, I'm feeling neglected. Like,
yeah.
Can you?
Yeah, my parents don't do that. My parents barely ever call me, but I do. I FaceTime with my dad about, you know, once a week, my dad and my mom about every Sunday. And we usually do it. Sometimes it's for 5 minutes. Sometimes it's for 20 minutes. And it's pretty regular. And they're very understanding. They're always like, you know, I don't want to get in your way. I know you're busy, blah, blah, blah. They understand all that. My dad was a very busy guy growing up. So it's normal in my family for the men to go out and be working all the time.
James, because you're a writer and a director, do you find the transition between the solitude of writing and then the high, because you're, you know, on a set like this, and I would imagine in pre-production, you're suddenly surrounded in pre-production, you know, by, I don't know, 50 to 100 people. And then when you're actually in production, you know, 400 people every day and constant phone call. I mean, do you find that? I would think that would be really hard in terms of just going from a silent internal exploration of like how you're writing your script to suddenly delegating and socializing. And I don't know, what do you think?
I think it's an adequate expression of who I am, because I think I have that part of myself that likes to isolate, that likes to be alone, that likes to just do, you know, explore myself and my imagination and play around by myself and have fun. And then I have that other part of me that's very social. So I, for me, the back and forth of that works really well with who I am as a human being. And it's not that crazy. I mean, being a director, it's a strange thing because, yeah, you do have a lot of people that are coming to you. But I also, I have a lot of gateways. So I'm really only talking to so many people every day.
Well, okay. So this is what I was going to open with. Because I was thinking about, I know that this podcast was going to be a little bit different than some of our other podcasts because you are a director and, you know, we have a lot of actors on our show and comedians. So there's a lot of like, whatever, like a lot of silly sloppiness. Yeah. But I know that you run deep, as Chris would put it. And you're an intellectual. And anyway, so
I think the most exciting thing about me doing this podcast is that Chris and I are so close and have spent so much time together.
Yeah.
Both on the set as collaborators, he's probably my closest collaborator the past couple of years, and offset just hanging out socially. And yet you and I have we went to dinner one night as a group, and then we've hung out a couple times. And then the other times that I've talked to you, I've basically been around you and your son. So this is the first time that we've ever actually talked, just the two of us, with a bunch of other people in the room.
Well, yeah. It's a huge honor for me. So thank you for doing this. And I got to tell you that Chris is so happy working with you. It really makes a huge difference. I see, you know, he's done a lot of movies now back to back, and he's had some great experiences. But as soon as he started Guardians 2, he had a different kind of joy about him. And I felt that, and it's really wonderful. And, you know, I'm on a show in LA, so I haven't been able to be around as much as I've wanted to. But I know that you guys have had some long nights, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's just, I adore him, and he is one of the closest things I have to a younger brother, and he's a great guy, and we have a great collaboration, you know, that our imaginations work very well, and we counter each other very well, and we're very, very different in just the right ways, and then the same in the right ways as well, and so I think that makes for a great collaboration.
Isn't it funny how, and he would get annoyed, he told me, he's like, but isn't it funny how Chris is easy? It's easy to think of him as one type of person. And then when you get to know him, he really can kind of take you by surprise.
Yeah, he's very, in a very simple way, I'd think the most unusual thing about Chris is he's a very serious guy.
Yeah.
And he is not, and he runs deep.
Yeah.
And I think that people think of him as this fun guy, which he is. He is a fun guy. But and not to sit here and talk about Chris's personality, but he's a really serious person who's very cerebral.
Very, and a lot of layers.
And that's a different type of actor to work with than, you know, some of the other actors I've worked with who are sort of very id-driven. You know, they're just kind of present and there and not really thinking. And Chris isn't like that. He's a thoughtful person.
We spend a lot of time, and this is the first time this has ever happened to me, but like late at night, like Chris and I will spend a lot of time talking about characters. I'll ask him about line delivery. We spend time like collaborating and brainstorming and making up like thinking about, you know, ridiculous projects and characters that we want to play. And I've never had that experience before with another actor.
Yeah.
And it taps into something that, I don't know, it's hugely satisfying for me. But I think to look at him, like, you know, he wears his big cowboy boots and his, like, America shirts and whatnot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it's easy to just think that he's one thing. And I don't know, it's one of the best things about him is that how he's kind of slowly, and it's not manipulative at all, but how he slowly kind of reveals his layers.
His differentness. And, yeah. And I think, you know, in a way that's true of a lot of people in the public eye, because people start to think of them as this one specific thing. And that's what my life is, that I'm this like uber fanatical geek, you know, and that's sort of my thing that I, you know, bring to the audience. But there's all these other aspects of my life that I think about a lot. And it's not really, you can't really be so public and be exactly what people think you are. It's just impossible. So
now, okay, and I promised Chris that I wouldn't talk too much about this, and I know you've talked a lot about this, but I can't help it. He's my husband. I'm super proud. And but in casting of him, because you cast him in The Game Changer for him.
Yeah, sure.
It's changed my life. It's, you know, it's had an incredible impact. And I know that he wasn't a likely choice at the time. He was pretty hefty and and, you know, pretty unknown, but I love it that you clearly wanted somebody to play Peter Quill who had a sense of humor, and I love it that you gave him there. I mean, there's that, I don't know how you feel about it, but there's that amazing, I don't know how you feel about it going viral, but there's that amazing audition piece between Chris,
him and Batista.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. That's how he got the role, because it was, I saw Chris read, I mean, people know this story about how I didn't want to see Chris for the role. And I
Why was that?
I thought he was the like chubby, funny guy from Parks and Rec. I didn't see it. And Sarah Finn, the casting director, kept pushing me until I saw him. And then I saw him, and I knew, and this is 100% true, within 20 seconds of him reading, I knew he was the guy.
Why? What was it?
Because, you know, I was looking for somebody who was like Downey was with Tony Stark, basically. Somebody who could fulfill all the words I had on the page, but at the same time brought something extra outside of that to the role. Because just being this charming, funny guy wasn't enough, if that makes sense.
Well, and Chris is a natural hustler. And a lot of us, he knows, he grew up, you know, not very wealthy or anything, and he's had a ton of different jobs, and he knows how to, so he has like that impish, mischievous hustler quality that Peter has.
Yeah, I also think it was he has a natural vulnerability about him as an actor, which is what makes him a movie star for this time period, because he does have a lot of classic movie star stuff. He does have a lot of Gary Cooper type stuff, but he has this vulnerability that is very different from those actors from the past. And that thing is that combined with the fallibility combined with the cockiness.
Yeah.
That's what made that character. And that's what was so different about him. But it was mostly, you know, it was just his charm, and he fit into the right role at the right time. And I told people back then, like as soon as we started going, you know, people would say, what about Chris Pratt? How did you cast, you know, somebody who's not well known for this big role? And I said, Chris Pratt is the biggest movie star in the world. People just don't know it yet.
Right.
And I'm really proud of the fact that I saw that off the bat.
I got to tell you, I would do anything for you, James, because I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Because I got to tell you, when I worked with him, we met doing a movie called Take Me Home Tonight in 2007 that was shelved for a long time. But when we were boyfriend and girlfriend in the movie, and sort of offset, I knew he was charming and popular and like an affable guy or whatever. But I didn't really take him. I didn't really start to really see him until I started acting with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, holy shit, this guy is really fucking good. And it like sent goosebumps. Because, you know, I bring to the table when I do a role, a pretty strong point of view. So and it frustrates me because oftentimes you work with actors who aren't bringing a strong point of view and they're like trying to find it in the moment, and it's like take 20 and you're like just like whatever. But and Chris brings that, you know, he brings a really strong point of view as well, and I just found that unbelievably sexy, just how good he was. And I don't know, it was really, I saw a shift in myself, and I remember thinking like, oh no, this is, he's got a lot. He's got a huge future.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like about just in the first movie, the biggest thing was just conversely and paradoxically getting Chris to stop entertaining. And if he could stop entertaining all of a sudden, then he is the most in, you know, rapturing that he could possibly be. That's what it was.
Well, James, I owe you a lot. Thank you so much for casting my husband. Okay, so I want to talk to you, a brief thing. This is something I've been thinking about. So I had a male, I won't go into too much detail about this, but I had a guy say to me, a frustrated actor, about 2001 after I got Scary Movie, he hadn't been working, and I was trying to sort of boost his ego or whatever, and he said something along the lines of, but Anna, because you did Scary Movie, you have achieved some kind of immortality. And I thought, the first thing I was like, oh my God, I hope it's not a fucking Scary Movie. I mean, I love Scary Movie, but I just, you know, I don't necessarily want to, like, whatever, that's my stamp on immortality. But I hadn't really thought about the idea of that kind of achievement I love material things and I love acting and everything, mm-hmm. but I hadn't really thought about the idea of needing to make a stamp or I don't know. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that because I know that it means it's sort of a question, and I had Sim write this down because I wanted to phrase it appropriately, that where you might have to admit to some degree of vanity.
Yeah, sure. You know? I have plenty of vanity. Don't worry. It's like I don't have to admit to some degree. It's been a huge driving force of much of my life.
But now that you have, I mean, you have had, you have an artistic imprint that, you know, will last until the zombies kill us. Even then they might really love Guy.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the thing is, it doesn't make any difference. It makes absolutely, I mean, yeah, sometimes I'm very competitive, first of all, like very competitive. So I really want to make the greatest possible movies I can make. And, you know, with Guardians Volume 2, I want to make the greatest spectacle film ever. Like, that's what I'm committed to. But at the same time, it doesn't make any difference. It's all building sandcastles because eventually we're all gone. Whether we, you know, we're gone or go somewhere else, we're gone. And, you know, being immortal means what? Like, how long is humanity really going to last? It's not immortality. And the overall scheme of things, it seems like nothing to me. I don't know if that's like a weird way to look at life, but I don't.
I think it's a healthy way to look at life.
I'm so zen about it. It's really about, you know, it's about the struggle. It's about doing what I feel like I was born to do. It's about really fulfilling what I think my, you know, reason is for being on this planet. And it's about serving other people at the end of the day and touching other people and making other people's lives a little bit easier because of what we do. And that is what drives me at the core of it all. And then I have this other part of me that, like I said, is really competitive and always has been. And somehow those two things exist in me side by side, and they seem like they're opposing, but they're really not, because
it seems
the competitive part of me helps serve other people.
Yeah. No, so, I think that's incredibly healthy because it's easy to get wrapped up in the vanity. And we talk a bit about this on the podcast, like the struggle with vanity in, especially in this industry, and especially as a woman, that for all different reasons and everything. But if you're looking, it's almost like if you're looking for the trophy from this industry, it will just continue to be, it will just always be elusive because you just have to figure, right? Like,
yeah, because what you do is, I mean, I think I learned it when I was young, and it was, you know, because I've been making movies for 20 years. And so when I first walked a red carpet, you know, and I'm like, you know what? In practice, this is not fun. Like, this is just, it seems like it's such a great thing when you're a kid and you imagine yourself walking the red carpet and everybody's going to be looking at you and you're going to be so cool. But really, it's just completely sort of humiliating.
Oh,
and you feel
yes.
like you're an animal. Oh. And then there's always the struggle for they're taking your picture or the person behind you and the publicists are pushing you around. And the whole thing is just completely humbling and humiliating and not at all it's not that exciting. And what you, when you're looking at somebody who's famous or successful outside of yourself and you're seeing that thing, that's the thing you want to be when you're young and you want to be famous and you want to be successful and you want to be rich. You're seeing that thing that doesn't exist because it is by its very nature outside of yourself, if that makes sense.
Oh, completely.
So it's like it's a worthless thing to chase after. And that's what I always tell people, because people are always telling me, you know, I want to be an actor, or I want to be a director. I want to be this thing. And I'm like, do you really?
Right.
Because it's really about, you know, Anna going to set every day and waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning and sitting there and going through this stuff and not really feeling the glory that other people think you have.
Right.
And enjoying that process. And yes, getting paid for it, which is great. But enjoying that process enough that it's worth doing, and feeling enough fulfillment from doing that that it's worth doing. And my dog is going through all your equipment right now.
I love it. No, but no, I don't know why you would have ever seen pictures of me on a red carpet, but I get so uncomfortable that all I do is like unhinge my jaw and I just make the craziest faces because I'm so awkward. I don't know how to close my mouth and do like the side thing that I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
With like the smoky eyes. So as a result, I have these crazy smoky eyes and I just look insane and people can see like my back molars and I'm just like, I never know how to hold my body. I feel like you said, it's like I haven't gotten that character down.
It's probably
that red carpet character.
I mean, how many people do you know that enjoy it? I can't think of anybody that enjoys doing the red carpet.
I don't know. I know that there are people because there are people that electively go to premieres that aren't their own.
I know, but they go because of the publicity they get.
Right. So,
but they don't go because they actually enjoy in the moment being on the carpet.
I think we just don't know these people, James, but I think they're out there and they may have a lot of reality television money.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's probably, you're right. There are people that don't
have. You know what I mean? Like,
they're so self-centered, they don't even have the awkwardness that comes with looking at yourself enough to say, this is so stupid. And yeah.
Because I'm with you, Chris and I, and, you know, I mean, I struggle a lot. And it's embarrassing almost to admit it because it sounds very arrogant. But I struggle a lot with the publicity side of
the
this
publicity
industry.
Side. It's a thing you think when I was a kid. It's a thing I imagine. Oh, doing the press junkets and this, and it ends up being the price you pay for everything else. And the movie coming out is the price you pay for doing the movie.
Yeah.
Because the part that's the best is the creation of it.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, you just have to let go. I mean, it does feel good when people like what you do and you get a note from a kid that says, my life changed because of seeing, you know, your film. I mean, that makes a great deal of difference to me. But primarily it's about having to be in the moment and creating that project, and the creation of it is the thing that has to turn you on. Otherwise, it's not worth doing. And that's why people who want to be actors or who want to be directors, they need to go out there and act and direct and make sure they really like doing it and can handle the rejection, which is huge.
You know, this is such a sidebar and Sim might get annoyed with me.
No, of course not.
We were talking about with an actress in an earlier podcast about this whole Ask Her More, hashtag Ask Her More concept.
Oh,
I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yes, yeah. It's about asking her more than what she wears.
Right. Which to me is like, it just feels so stupid. It's like, those are like the 20 seconds that you spend with each journalist that you just have to get it over with. You just have to do it. And if you can just tell somebody what you're wearing, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, can't we, I don't know. I like the intention.
You like ask me, hashtag ask me less.
Yeah, ask me less. But I mean, I love the intention behind it. The intention
exactly.
is pure. But
it doesn't really have
the movement feels
it doesn't
so
have the performers themselves in mind, because it just makes things more difficult for this process we already dislike doing.
Yeah, and it's like it's not acknowledging, I guess, to sort of the frivolousness
of the entire
of the whole thing
extravaganza.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a side note. Okay, but I want to hear. Okay, now I know. I want to talk to you for hours. Okay, so Will you tell us a little bit, though, about how you, I know this is a story you've probably told a lot, but maybe in your own words, a little bit about how you got Guardians, and how, I know I was shocked to hear that you were going to start a podcast and I love you even more. I didn't think I could love you more than I did already. But anyway, but then shortly after.
Well, I was telling you right before we started, I mean, I really was getting to the place in my career where I, you know, I had made a couple of movies. They were lower budget films. One was very critically acclaimed. One was not as critically acclaimed. Neither one of them made much money. One of them made a little bit of money, the less critically acclaimed one. The other one didn't. And so it was the time with movies when all of a sudden I was like, holy crap, this whole, my whole life, I thought I was going to be the successful director, and I've been working towards that. If that was just was what was going to happen, and maybe that's not going to happen. And I started saying, you know, I was making money doing some video game stuff. I was making money, you know, doing other things. I was involved with a TV project that I was going to do. And I was like, you know what? But mostly I felt like a lot of the films just weren't being seen by people, and that the movies that really matter today were these big spectacle films, because those were the only movies that people went to the theater to see. And other than that, I might as well just be doing TV, because TV is really the media that people you know, are connected to today, and video games, which people are really connected to. So I want to have an audience. So that was what was interesting to me at that time. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, people go to see Marvel movies. And I said this to my agent at the time. I'm like, you know, people go to see Marvel movies. They go to see these big spectacle films, but nobody's going to give me that. They're not going to give me that right now. So I just want to focus on TV and video games and do that. And so I kind of dropped out. And about 2 weeks later, after I made this big proclamation, I got a call from Marvel, who I'd gotten calls from before. I knew them, and said, you know, we want to pitch you something. Will you come in? And I was like, it's all the way down in Manhattan Beach, which is like an hour away from Studio City where I live. And I was like, and I almost said no, because I'm like, I'm not really doing movies right now. I don't know. And plus, they're not going to give me this anyway. And I go down, I go
in. So I don't know how that part works. So they want to pitch you, and then you, what's the process?
I mean, in all honesty, I think 40, sorry, I keep not talking to the mic. I think in all honesty, probably 15 directors passed on Guardians of the Galaxy because nobody knew what it was. And they finally get to the list where it's like, oh, James Gunn. So that's really what it is. I mean, my story is not that much different than Chris's with getting the lead, except for
we all have a version of
Kevin Feige is me.
Yeah.
So it was like getting to that place. And yeah, then they had a list of directors that I guess they wanted to talk to about the project. And I came in, I was one of those directors. They pitched me on this idea of Guardians of the Galaxy.
And then are you supposed to, like, I just don't know how the mechanics work. Are you supposed to take away and then bring back? Like,
yes.
Okay.
The first meeting was them pitching to me. And then if I was interested, the second meeting would be me pitching to them.
Okay.
And they pitched this idea of Guardians of the Galaxy to me. They showed me some initial art they had done from early on. And I knew who the Guardians of the Galaxy were. I'm a big Marvel Comics fan. But I thought it was not a great idea for a movie, and I thought it was weird. And I really wanted to do something that was big and commercial, and I was like, I don't know, this might be stupid. I didn't really see it, and so I kind of smiled and shook hands and left and was like, nah, I don't think so. I'm not going to pursue this. And on my way, stuck in traffic on the way home from Manhattan Beach, which took me an hour and a half to get home, all of a sudden, I saw the movie in my head, and I was like, oh, I get it. It was all based around Rocket, and it was like this character that I thought was going to be like, because I thought it was going to be like Bugs Bunny in the middle of the Avengers when they first told it to me, and I'm like, well, wait a second. What if that raccoon was real in some way? Like, if a raccoon really talked, it sounds stupid, but if a raccoon really talked, how would it be created to talk? And what it seemed to me was like this incredibly sad story about this little animal that was taken and messed with to the point where he became a talking murderous raccoon. And it seemed so incredibly sad at the center of it that it grounded me And then the whole sort of visual aspect of it came to me. And I felt as if there was a big hole in modern spectacle films, because everything was so gritty and grimy and either just boring looking or just dirty and grimy. And to bring a movie with a lot of color to it, a lot of excitement, a lot of pop. And I just saw what the movie could be. And it was really those two things, the idea of where Rocket came from and the idea of visually what the film could be. And I went home and I wrote down this 15-page document about the look of the movie. And I connected it to all these different artists, Chris Foss and a lot of other people who I'd seen their work in the past. And then it was a reaction against, you know, back when Blade Runner and Alien came out, those movies were very dark and gritty. And from then on, all science fiction movies were so dark and gritty, and that's the way they looked real. And it became sort of a trope because things became serious simply because they were dark and gritty. And to react against that, to create something that was different than that, to give people something that their eyes and brains needed, that also had a lot of heart. And also gave kids something that I had when I was a kid and I saw Star Wars. And I remember going into the you know, supermarket and seeing C-3PO on the cover of People magazine and going, oh, what is that guy? Like, that's the coolest thing. Or seeing Chewbacca and being like, oh my God, what's Chewbacca? You know, what's that hairy dude? I think he's a good guy and he's a monster. And to be able to say, I wanted to create a movie that wasn't like Star Wars, but that, you know, made kids feel how Star Wars made me feel as a kid.
Well, the strength of Star Wars was for me as a viewer, and not, I'm like not a fan of a ton, but I was a huge Star Wars fan, and I'm a fan of good, interesting movies, but mostly a fan of great characters. Mm-hmm. And what Star Wars had, they had great characters that were very well rounded.
Yeah. And specific.
And developed, and Guardians the same way. I mean, that opening sequence, I'm so biased, of course, because it's my husband. But of Chris, like, I mean, dancing, it's unbelievable. It just fills you with joy.
Yeah.
And it's a dark world.
And it's in this dark world where he's dancing and he's oblivious to the fact that there's skeletons everywhere. Yeah, that's
yeah,
really...
it's so wonderfully confusing in the best way.
Yeah, and in that original document, that was all the contrasts in the movie, the ugliness contrasted with the beauty. And there's always those contrasts in Guardians all the way throughout, you know, whether it's emotionally or visually or whatever. And so that was where it all started for me. So I wrote up that document, I gave it to Marvel. And they were like, whoa. And then I think at that point, it was like five directors. I had to go in. I had to fly into Wilmington to pitch to.
And at this point, you're obviously becoming more invested and passionate, I would imagine.
At this time, in all honesty, until that time in my career, I thought all of my successes, and although I didn't have a lot of financial success as a director, I had quite a bit of financial success as a screenwriter. And I always thought the secret to my success was the fact that I was 100% committed and 100% couldn't give a shit. And that combination... Oh, my cat's on the table now.
I got
animals everywhere. Emily, please.
I love that your cat's name is Emily.
Yeah.
Hi, Emily.
Wait, what's that on the...
That's a GPS, because she has a tendency to wander out to try to get away, and she's an escape
that
artist.
That is
so
awesome.
She's not supposed to go outside, but she does so every chance she gets. She's a little Houdini. I can't remember what I was talking about.
Oh, no. We were getting to a great story. You had had some financial success.
Oh, I always thought, I always thought my success was because I didn't care. You know, because I really, there's a part of me that's really lazy that doesn't want to get the job because then I have to work. And so, I for the first time in my life doing Guardians, I cared about, you know, the outcome. Come on, Ems.
After a vetting process, I guess, akin to auditioning as an actor.
I think I was against five directors and I was against three directors and it was down to two people and then it was just me. And then I got the gig and my agent called me and I was at my girlfriend's apartment at the time and they said, you know, you've got the gig. And I felt like a young girl winning American Idol with the confetti coming down on my head and
That's
the lights
awesome.
Flashing and the whole bubbles.
I have a competitive spirit very much like yours, I think, which is like, because I'm proud. So if I think, I don't care if Emily is up on the table.
Okay.
Not at all. I love cats. We've had this argument before, Sim and I.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that's actually, well, anyway. But like, if there are things that I just know that I'm not good at, I refuse to do them. Like bowling.
Yeah.
Or pool.
Yeah.
Or, and I'll or like, even if I have an audition for a role that I don't quite have
yeah.
a good grip on
yeah.
it. I'll emotionally distance myself from it, even though I'm not, even though, of course, because I'm competitive, I want to win everything. But I would imagine especially as like the director pool is shrinking, you're still in consideration and your vision keeps growing stronger and stronger for the project. How by the time when you got it, I would, at least as an actor, I know how I would feel like,
I was like, hugely relieved, but also excited. I mean, it was,
it was
great. It was one of, those truly happy moments in life.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's awesome. Okay. Well, congratulations, James. And you did marvel well.
I didn't know I wasn't going to be able to rest for the next 5 years.
No, it's amazing. And I've been to both sets of the first Guardians, which was unbelievable, is outside of London. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, it's huge.
And then here, which is in Atlanta. Listeners, we're on the road. I can't remember if I mentioned
No, we didn't mention it yet.
We're on the road.
We got right into it.
We're in Atlanta visiting Chris and bugging James at his house. anyway, so here we are. And guess what? Sim had to set up the equipment again all by himself.
I have no idea if we're even recording.
Okay, so now we're going to do a little bit of a rapid fire.
Great. I'm ready.
Okay.
Go.
At some point, if we have time, I want to talk to you about your directing style, but that's just
sure.
an actory thing. But
good.
Okay. Okay.
It's awful. I'm awful.
I didn't see that. I think you're amazing.
You know how I pushed everyone. Let's just keep doing it again and again and again.
I love
right?
that, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to talk to you more about that if we have time.
Yeah.
About
sure.
Okay. Item of clothing you can't bear to part with. If the house is burning, is there one piece?
Please tell me it's a t-shirt you're wearing right now, which says yes, body by Cupcakes.
Oh, that's Johnny Cupcakes t-shirt. He's going to love that I mentioned him.
I love it.
You're not like that.
I don't. Yeah. I mean, I guess, I would just. My
you
mind,
don't have like a listen, t-shirt that's so well worn that you just love.
This is how I think. When I was a little kid, my grandmother had a really massive, expensive doll collection that she had spent her whole life,
this is a sad story, isn't it?
She had spent her whole life collecting. And at one point she took in all her grandkids. I think there were six. I think there were nine grandkids. And she took us in and she said, okay, one by one, you pick the one you want. And then you go back and then you start back with that. That one person gets to pick two and then go on. And we go on and, I go up and I'm like, Grandma, which one costs the most money? And she says, that Shirley That's Temple amazing. Doll. And I said, I want the Shirley Temple doll. And then my brother comes up and he's like, I want the teddy bear. And my sister comes up and she's like, I want that cute little Raggedy Ann doll. And then they keep going and going. And then it comes back to me and I go, which is the most expensive up there now, Grandma? And I said, I want that one. And I just picked the most expensive dolls. And so when you ask me what item of clothing I would pull out of my house, I guess a Dolce suit or something because it's worth the most money.
Oh, that's amazing.
But I would really, if there was a fire, I would only care about my animals. As long as my animals are safe. Mm-hmm. And secondly, probably my hard drive, then I'd be all right.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay. First concert you attended?
A band called The Motels, who sang a song called Only the Lonely. And I was pretty young, and an older kid drove me from school, and she was very drunk, the lead singer, and didn't get on stage until like, it felt like it was 3 o'clock in the morning, but it was probably like midnight or something. And I remember calling my dad from a payphone being like, oh, she hasn't gone on yet. He was like, Jimmy, get home. But I was with my older friend who wasn't going to leave because my dad was angry and I got in a lot of trouble. So, yeah.
Last concert you attended?
The old 97s. So probably my favorite band. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
When was that?
That was right before I left Los Angeles.
So yeah. Like 3 years ago.
Like 9 months ago, yeah.
Most impressive dish you cook?
Cream of wheat. I'm really, really good at making cream of wheat.
I love a good cream of wheat.
Oh, it's the best.
Do you do a little butter, a little brown sugar?
Oh, yeah. A little butter, a little brown sugar, 100% milk, whole milk if it's available. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a twist on it, too. My mom used to be obsessed with, like, packing us with protein and calcium.
Uh-huh.
So she would whisk an egg. Have you ever done this?
Uh-uh.
You whisk an egg, and then but then you have, because you don't want the egg to cook, it turns the cream of wheat a little bit yellow. I love Emily. Emily's on the table again.
Wait,
and
you put the egg in there?
Okay, so you whisk an egg, right, in a separate bowl, and then you slowly add little dollops of cream of wheat while you're whisking it, because you don't want the egg to cook. You
right.
want it to become scrambled. So you have to slowly incorporate the egg, and then you eventually, after you've gotten the egg a little bit more incorporated, then you dump it into the cream of wheat, and it makes it a little bit yellow. You don't taste the egg or anything.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it is
okay, I'm definitely
delicious.
Doing that.
Okay. Give it a
I've
whirl.
Tried taking like Chinese, these flavor packets for soup, like black sesame, and putting that in cream of wheat.
Wow.
And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Wow, I like this. This is James Gunn cream of wheat cookbook.
It's the only thing I can cook. Like,
Sim, this will finally get our sponsor.
Yeah. Cream
awesome.
Of wheat. Yeah.
Finally.
They tweeted
so
me
long.
The other day. They tweeted me the other day, and I was like a young girl getting tweeted by Beyonce because that's as exciting. I love cream of wheat so much. Yeah.
Okay. Would you rather never be able to use Google or any internet search engine again, or have everyone see everything you've ever searched for on Google?
Oh. I definitely. I guess I'd have to give up Google.
But no, you have a great defense.
I have two assistants.
Yeah.
I can just have search for me.
But think
hey,
about
Jake, look up this.
Your character defense. Like, you could be looking up, like, I don't anything in the world, and you could still make a fairly strong case that you're looking up for a bad guy.
I don't know how far internet porn takes you
right.
into character.
What do you call a menage a trois? Like, what do you call like an octagonal? Like, if you've got eight people having sex.
An orgy?
That's an orgy, or it's a gangbang, or it could be a bunch of different things.
Oh, I just wish there was a spectrum.
I wasn't going to go there, but that
could be a what?
A bukkake.
A bukkake? What's that?
Oh, yeah.
We don't have to get into it.
Please.
All right, James, go ahead and explain it to Anna.
Who's listens to this podcast?
Nobody.
Does a bunch of young kids listen to it?
No, I always tell them to fuck off.
It's a kind of Japanese, generally Japanese porn where a bunch of men stand around a woman and have an orgasm on top of the woman.
So they do a circle jerk
on top,
top
of
a
woman.
Woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That sounds like fun.
As bad as it is for the woman, like which you focus on immediately, you go, oh my God, that's disgusting. I would never want to be one of those dudes. That's disgusting.
Do you remember Chat Roulette?
Yes.
So my friend and I used to go on Chat Roulette, and there was a time when you could actually like meet a stranger and actually kind of have, there was a very brief window where you could actually like be talking to somebody, some drunk person in you know, not Yugoslavia, but like whatever, all across the world. And it was kind of fascinating. And then it quickly became a bunch of dudes just jerking off.
Yeah.
So my friend and I would go on, and because I was a little annoyed, because I really did enjoy talking to, as you can see, I started a podcast talking to strangers, but we would root for them. We'd be like, go, 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 you can do it. You can come, go, 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 you can do it. You can do it.
You'd be watching a guy jerking off?
Our hope was that we would annoy them so much that they would.
But did they like it?
We usually got nexted, I would say, between like 2 to 4 minutes. Because it started to sound very mocking. Yeah, it was a surprisingly long time.
I know, but I think a lot of guys want that.
But we were like, yay, come on, you can do it, you can do it. Let's go, rub hard.
I'm just like picturing guy, you know, masturbating, and then all of a sudden he sees Anna Faris as his cheerleader.
Yay! You can
right.
do it. You can
You're
do it.
You're already well known by that time.
Exactly.
That's even
I know. That's got to be the strangest thing ever. How many guys went to completion?
I never saw anyone go to completion.
Okay, great. Mm.
Our goal was to frustrate them.
I talked to a woman one time who worked in one of those booths, you know?
Oh, yeah?
And she told me a lot of stories that were so disgusting that I would imagine some of those guys would really like the you can do it, you can go thing.
Well, what if I told you?
Because it seems like the majority of guys that came into that situation were guys that wanted her to be mean to them.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, what if I told you that my friend was a guy?
Oh, I guess that makes a difference.
And yeah. also kind of a well-known actor. Ah.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Was it, it was Tom Cruise?
So if you have like these two idiots that are like, yeah. yay, you yeah, can do it, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know, I was imagining it was two women.
Come on, yeah, yay, yeah. whoopee.
And this guy is absolutely hysterical
like,
too.
Yeah, he's like, come on, dude. Come on, man. Rub it out. Come on. Yeah.
we'll tell you after who it is.
It's so horrifying to me to be you guys that I can't. I'm like,
it was my chat. Because
I've been
revenge.
On there for like 2 seconds. I went on there with my ex-girlfriend. And I remember we were trying to pretend we were dead or something like that. So they would come, you know. I couldn't really stand it. I get really easily grossed out, which is surprising yeah, considering some of the too. Movies I make.
Really?
So easily
so
grossed
what
out.
About like, just, okay, setting aside sexual stuff, what about like blood and like, could you ever be a surgeon?
Yeah, I worked in a hospital. I saw people when I was a kid. I worked as an orderly, and I saw people die and all that stuff. That Whoa. Didn't bother me. But I don't like poop.
Yeah.
And I especially don't like the idea of poop. So like my I really like the show Togetherness.
I do too.
My girlfriend and I were watching it, and we were totally. She kept laughing at me because I kept showing baby poop, and every time that baby poop came on, I had to turn my head and put my hand against the screen. Because I found it so incredibly disgusting, and it was ruining the whole show for me. And they did it like three times
yeah,
or four
need the
times.
Insert of the baby poop.
Oh, it was so There's gross! It no was so gross. That. But that's the kind of thing. I mean, obviously, it's just pudding or something.
What about if somebody vomits? Does that like?
Well, I don't like that, but I don't think I have the same reaction
it
that
like gay.
Other
it
people do.
Like...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what sitcom world would you most want to live in? Were you a fan of sitcoms?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because I know my answer, but I don't want to...
I know my answer already.
What's what your is your answer? Emma?
Cheers.
Oh, that's a
but
good one.
They're sit around a bar and hang out. And
they're sort of depressed at Cheers. They're all sort of depressed people.
I got a pretty good one.
What is yours?
Golden Girls. Florida. Golden Girls.
Yeah.
Palms.
Yeah, that's...
Come on, James.
Come on, come live with me. Golden Girls is probably not. I guess Mork and Mindy, I guess, because he's like a spaceman. It's funny.
Yeah. All right.
That was the first thing that came to mind.
What about
Alf?
Fam?
No, I love Alf.
Alf.
Oh,
Alf.
My God. He's so funny. He wants to eat cats.
Okay, now we've got a handful of Twitter questions.
Uh-huh.
Three that we've picked. This is the first time second
we've
time?
Done it a couple times. Yeah, but this is an amazing response, by the way. I went through about
we
200
flooded.
Questions. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw them yesterday. They were tweeting it.
Oh, right. You retweeted it.
Yes,
thank you so much for doing that.
Okay, so at Gil Daniels wants to know, what's the work/life balance like on a film set? How many hours of sleep, partying, et cetera, goes on? Well, I mean, we talked a little bit about this.
I honestly, at this point in the schedule, I get okay sleep, but I don't do anything else. I like truly don't do anything else. So I wake up at 7. I go to work. I come home. Usually, I try to get into bed, you know, a little past 10. Go to sleep. Do it again. And that's pretty much my life completely. Maybe then the weekends, maybe I have one day off that I rest.
You do
and
a
then
podcast.
The other day.
So
I do a podcast for fun on that day. And then on the other day, I usually work. And as it gets closer to the ending, though, we're in the halfway point, so it's actually the most difficult part. But as it gets closer to the ending, it gets a little better because some of the planning goes away. So the after shoot meetings start to die down. The weekends start to die down. So it becomes easier as you get near the end of the shoot. And then editing, I love. That's more like a real job. Mm-hmm. You know,
but that's tough to be in a dark room, I think.
No, but it's only...
You love it.
I don't spend, you know, 12 hours a day in the editing room, you know.
Oh, that's good.
Okay, you know, it's like I go in there, I give all my notes, I step out for a couple hours, I go back, I give a bunch more notes, I sit with them to make specific cuts, and it's, you know, many hours a day, but it's not the same thing. I get to go out to dinner
at
night and things
right.
like that, yeah, that I can't do now.
Okay, at Dax Shepherd 1. I just adore you, Dax. Wants to know, do you have any room in that beautiful franchise for a lanky doofus?
I actually responded to him on Twitter.
You
and I
did?
Said, we always have room for lanky doofuses. So I think Dax is
what about
is
short
a,
blonde doofus?
Yeah, we have. Well, we definitely have room for that.
Okay, so we're going to do a caller.
Okay, great.